Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
From the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm David Reed. Foreign countries were generally puzzled by the U.S. government's partial shutdown. And with the debt authorization deadline fast approaching, the newspaper Le Monde's front page story had this headline, referring to France's favorite founding father: "Jefferson, wake up, they've gone crazy." But there was real anxiety in foreign countries who are invested heavily in U.S. currency and are dependent on its economic well-being. And on the day the government came to its senses and reopened, President Barack Obama was in no mood for humor. Here's what he had to say from the White House.
Some of the same folks who pushed for the shutdown and threatened default claim their actions were needed to get America back on the right track, to make sure we're strong. But probably nothing has done more damage to America's credibility in the world, our standing with other countries, than the spectacle that we've seen these past several weeks. It's encouraged our enemies, it's emboldened our competitors, and it's depressed our friends who look to us for steady leadership.
On our program today, we'll talk with an American correspondent in Asia and a Danish correspondent in Washington to assess the international fallout from those 16 days when the U.S. government was partially shut down and wondering whether it would be able to pay its bills. But first, WorldWatch, a brief summary of international news with Raymond Tungekar.
France and Germany are criticizing the United States for spying on the two European nations. During a phone call with President Obama, German Chancellor Angela Merkel complained about reports that her cell phone was bugged by U.S. intelligence agencies. This came days after the French daily Le Monde published details on widespread American surveillance of French phone calls and text messages. French officials called the spying, quote, "totally unacceptable," and demanded a clear answer. U.S. officials have denied the accusations. Saudi Arabia has turned down a non-permanent seat on the UN Security Council. The Saudis question the group's effectiveness in ending conflicts such as the civil war in Syria and the Palestinian fight for territory. Middle Eastern allies have publicly backed the decision. UN authorities have called the move unexpected. Officials in Greece are conducting a nationwide search for the parents of a young girl thought to be abducted by a Roma couple. Police discovered the 5- or 6-year-old girl during a raid on a Roma camp last week. A DNA test confirmed they were not related, prompting a search for her biological parents. The Roma couple listed the girl as one of their 14 children so they could get a monthly welfare payment of 2,500 euros. The scandal has prompted a nationwide debate about welfare fraud. In Brazil, a multi-billion-dollar oil rights auction led to street protests. Many Brazilians opposed the country's decision to sell a deep-water oil field to foreign companies and lose valuable national resources. More than 1,000 security officers were guarding the hotel in Rio de Janeiro where the auction took place. Police fired rubber bullets and tear gas at protesters, and 4 people were wounded. Brazil's state-controlled oil company will own 40% of the undersea oil. Shell, a French company, and a pair of Chinese firms will each get 20% ownership. And that's it for WorldWatch.
Joining me now is Steve Herman. He's the Southeast Asia Bureau Chief for Voice of America. And Erkan Özden. He's the Washington correspondent for the Danish Broadcasting Corporation. Welcome to Global Journalist.
Pleasure to be here.
Let's start with a picture worth 1,000 words. It's the group photograph from the Asian Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit in Bali. It shows the presidents of China and Russia smiling front and center. America's president was missing, stuck at home, dealing with this domestic crisis. So, Steve, was it a big deal that Obama canceled his week-long tour of Southeast Asia?
Well, it certainly got a lot of press, we can put it that way. But I think that there was a little bit too much made of it. Yes, it allowed leaders, especially leaders of China, to have the spotlight without sharing it with the president of the United States, who will always grab the limelight just by his presence there. But I think this was just a blip on the screen. It's not going to have any significant long-standing effects on U.S. influence or U.S. diplomacy.
Okay. And, Erkan, I imagine that Europeans are weary of dealing with this, with their own drawn-out crisis over the common currency. So what were some of the main reactions to the monetary crisis in the world's largest economy?
There was a lot of reaction to this. We were covering this day and night almost the first couple of days. I mean, the debt ceiling thing later, of course, too. So it was a very, very, very important story. I can't speak for all of Europe, obviously, but maybe Northern Europe or Denmark at least. We were doing live shots all the time about this, doing packages. Mm-hmm. And here in Washington, obviously, in front of the Congress, I was meeting all of my colleagues from, you know, France and Germany and all the other European countries who think this is a big deal, obviously, because there, as you mentioned, there is a financial crisis in Europe and has been for many years, and whatever happens in America will also have an effect in Europe. That's the feeling, at least. So it is very important.
Was it difficult explaining what was going on in Washington to people who don't live here?
It is, to some extent, difficult to explain it, especially the political game, because we, if I take my point of departure in Denmark, we have a very different system. I mean, it's a monarchy. We have a parliament. Our elections are 1 month, the campaign, and that's it. Here you have different chambers, you have the president. It's a much more complicated political game, and it's difficult to explain to people in Denmark, for instance, who have universal health care, were born and raised with it. We've had it for many, many years. So why is it that the Americans are against it? That question pops up all the time, and we have to explain that, obviously.
Steve, I imagine you also had some perplexed people you were talking with in Asia.
Oh, I think most certainly. And as an American and a journalist, I can say I had difficulty attempting to explain the how and why in rational terms as far as what was going on in Washington. I don't know of any country which viewed it as a positive thing. And as you might know, China's official news outlets and commentators did call into question America's leadership abilities and whether it wasn't time, for example, to shift away from the U.S. dollar as the world currency. But no one, not even the Chinese, are demonstrating any movement away from the greenback. China allows its currency to float in a defined range against the U.S. dollar, and the Hong Kong dollar is pegged to the U.S. dollar, et cetera. So I haven't seen that even China is putting its money where its mouth is. It's bad-mouthing the United States, taking opportunities regarding this to bring into question U.S. hegemony, as they would put it. But there's been no significant changes that we've noticed.
But has there been a detraction from the president's foreign policy goals? Do you think there's any sort of long-term loss of reputation as far as how it deals with other countries?
Long-term, no. I really don't think so. This got a lot of print, as I said, and it was definitely a bit of a setback. But I think a number of commentators and journalists have made a little bit too much out of it. And time will tell, I guess. We may look back on this 20 years from now and say this was a seminal moment, but I don't think so.
And Erkan, what's your perspective on the long-term possible damages this caused to America's reputation?
I mean, I spoke to some people, especially in the financial sector, both here in Washington and back home in Denmark, and there was some concern. And they were saying, listen, I mean, how can we take America seriously if this goes on and on and on? And we have the issue again in January. But long term, I don't see this as a huge problem because we are in Europe pretty pro-American in many ways, and at least in Scandinavia and in Denmark, we've been leaning to America for many, many years, ever since the Second World War. So it is a very close ally. And we have so many Danes and Scandinavians, millions almost, who travel to America every single year. So I don't see that there's a problem there in the relation, but maybe somewhat of some disappointment maybe in the population that how can this happen in an advanced country like America? Why don't they just solve this? So absolute astonishment in a way.
And most of the Danes seem to support Obama and kind of are perplexed by what the Republican Party is doing. Is it difficult to report this in an unbiased way?
you have to take care, obviously. That's very important as a journalist in this case. And you are right that it wouldn't be unfair to say that at least most Europeans, most Danes, would be leaning to Obama and think, well, he's a bit more like us because we're a social democrat country and a government is big and we have universal health care and all that. So that wouldn't be wrong to say. But also it's very difficult. It's important that we try to explain that it's not necessarily because the conservatives are stupid. I mean, to say that way, that's not the case. We have to explain that this is a situation where there are different ideologies. It's just a different way of thinking. So we're not necessarily always in line with Democrats or Republicans or whatever. I mean, we need to explain that it is much more complicated. I mean, there are nuances to this.
And is the perspective from Southern Europe a bit different from Northern Europe on this issue?
There will definitely be differences from country to country because you Americans make the same mistake that we do often, that you say over there in Europe. I saw an interview of a funny situation a couple of weeks ago where an American in London was talking about a situation in Russia, which I was laughing about. But we do the same thing. We say over there in America, what do they think? Or what's the implication? But it depends on which state you're in. And that's obvious for you people in America, that there are huge differences between states in America. And that's also difficult to explain to a Danish or European audience because they have this feeling that it's one big country. And obviously it is, but there are huge differences. Mm-hmm. And if you often focus on the East Coast, New York, or the West Coast, Los Angeles, where many tourists have been, you miss that there is actually a huge America in between. And some would say that's the real America in a sense. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Now, Steve, let's get more into a little bit more specific coverage issues. Al Jazeera America criticized the primary U.S. news outlets for describing the shutdown as a result of generalized dysfunction or gridlock or stalemate. And the Al Jazeera, a media newcomer, said that what really happened was, quote, aberrational behavior by a political party that is willing to take extreme and potentially damaging action to get its way. And by not calling it what it is, the political press is enabling it. Do you think that the coverage of this was fair and balanced to a point of not really telling the true picture?
Well, I would say that from the media here, in this region, there was very superficial coverage. Unlike the European media, most of the Southeast Asian media do not have full-time correspondents or bureaus in Washington. Now, that's different in North Asia, where both the Japanese and Korean networks have correspondents based in Washington and New York. So the coverage here of the issue, especially in the broadcast media, was extremely superficial. And in the vernacular press here as well, I don't think there was much in-depth reporting that was going on, just because they don't have the people in place to really analyze it sufficiently. Remember, a lot of these countries are developing countries. What we do at the Voice of America is broadcast in a number of languages to these countries because they either do not have a developed media infrastructure or they don't have a free press.
Erkan, would you want to weigh in on that question?
I think we tried to do our best, absolutely, to cover both sides. And we had a very, very extensive coverage of this. Bear in mind that we have the six-hour time difference here. So whenever it's midnight here, it's 6 o'clock in the morning in Denmark. So I kind of have twice a day I work in a way, because I do TV and have two shows, which is 12:30 and 3:30 here in America. And then you go home and have your dinner, and then you start working again, because then you have to be on at midnight, 2 hours until 8 o'clock in the morning, which is 2 o'clock in the morning here, which is an interesting cycle, but which means there is a huge demand from back home. So I was doing 5, 6, 7 live shots at midnight, and I was doing live shots during the day. I was doing packages. I was going to Gettysburg. I was doing local stuff here in Washington, and there was a huge demand to get explanations, talk to regular people, talk to federal employees, talk to all the people involved. And there was absolute demand too to talk to not only one side, but also absolutely talk to conservatives, Republicans, Democrats. You see, you can't fool the Danish people, the Scandinavian people, because they know too much. Right. They come here, they travel here, they follow the news. Everybody speaks English. So you can't just come up with a bias, because people will be angry. Even though they don't support conservatives or Republicans, they'll say, hey, there are two sides to this story. You need to cover the other side too.
Right. There's a basic sense of fairness. Yeah,
absolutely. I do think there is. And I think we're known for that in Scandinavia, to at least try to be very fair, even though we're always accused of being socialist and left-wing and all that.
All right. Now, a Reuters report quoted Joseph Nye. He's the Harvard professor who coined the term soft power to describe a nation's ability to wield influence through its culture, values, and governance rather than just by force. And Nye said the United States had suffered a serious blow from the shutdown as far as the soft power. Steve, would you agree with that from your perspective?
Well, I can tell you that I cited quite frequently in my master's degree thesis Professor Nye, because my thesis did deal with soft power. But I think I, from my perspective on the ground here in this region, I would beg to disagree a bit with the esteemed professor. I think it was a temporary setback for the United States, that it's not probably going to have any long-lasting effect. Obviously, the absence of Mr. Obama allowed China's leader to bask in the spotlight, not be overshadowed by the U.S. president on the same stage. So it did score China extra points in terms of public diplomacy. But I really do think it's a fleeting moment, and mm-hmm. that the United States has such a significant presence with hard power and soft power in Asia. This is not something that has evaporated overnight.
Now, but China is kind of getting better at this soft power game. Would you agree, Steve, as far as what it's doing with
they're spending a lot of money. There, if you look at just the from the media perspective, I believe that China now has about an $8 billion, that's with a B, billion-dollar budget for media expansion overseas. I think the CCTV newsroom in Washington, D.C. has 100 people in it now. That's more than I think some of the American networks there. So they're definitely throwing money at it. But will China convince significant percentage of people in countries that it is a warm, wonderful, touchy-feely country as far as its intentions? The Chinese are also pouring tremendous amount of money into infrastructure projects. They want a Western outlet to the sea in Asia. So they're looking at investments into roads and railways and ports in Southeast Asia. It's a win-win situation for China and its neighbors. But some countries are looking at the experience that Africa had with Chinese infrastructure projects, and they're saying, wait a minute, do we really want this sort of influence from China in our own country? And if you look at certain countries, for example, when I go to Vietnam, people mm-hmm. treat me wonderfully as an American. And, you know, you might be taken aback saying, wait, you know, we have a little bit of recent history. But you have to remember that the animosity between the United States and Vietnam lasted 15 years. Sounds like a long time. But the animosity between China and Vietnam has been going on over a period of 1,000 years.
Right. And Erkan, from your perspective, viewing this expansion mode by China, how do your viewers and listeners see the China versus U.S. power play?
I think there is, it wouldn't be unfair to say that there is a big portion of distrust with the Chinese still. So I would say most Europeans, at least where I come from, people are still leaning to America whenever they look for support or whenever they need. I mean, it is their biggest ally, and this is not going to change that long term. I don't think this is going to have a big impact, because America is an extremely close ally, and it goes a long time back. And there is the language thing. We understand Americans better. We feel they understand us better. So that's very, very tight, that relationship. So although there has been some disappointment and some anger back home and some worry, that this economy thing could influence us, it's still like it's a concern. I mean, they look at it, I think, maybe like a big brother who's in trouble maybe for a while, and you hope he's going to get back on his feet again. That's the way I'm seeing it.
And Steve, the big brother analogy, is that suitable to Asia?
Well, I think China wants to be the big brother in Asia. It sees that as its historical role in the region, and a number of countries over the centuries were vassal states or suzerainties of China. And China sees that as putting things back in the natural order. And the presence of the 7th Fleet of the United States Navy, as well as the military bases in Japan and Korea, are a barrier to that. And we've spoken before on other programs about the issues in Northeast Asia with the disputes, territorial disputes between Japan and China. And most countries in this region want the United States to maintain a presence here. It's a very different culture. Europe and the United States have great historical similarities. That's not the case necessarily between Eastern and Western culture, but because of China being the dominant force previously in history and again in the future, countries want to hedge their bets here.
Okay. Now, Erkan, I know you have to get to another assignment in just a minute, but before I let you go, could you give me your prediction on whether we're going to be telling this, going through this turmoil again in February when we were debating the budget again?
That's a very interesting question. That was actually one of the questions that I got a lot during the last couple of live shots. Are we going to see this again in January and February? And, you know, we may well see it, even though we have this committee who's going to sit down now and figure out how they can make a long-term deal. Well, how did that go during the sequester talks? I mean, it's not like we avoided the sequester. So I do think that a lot of Americans, at least, are very skeptical and are thinking, listen, we're going to go through this one more time. It's just kicking the can down the road. Mm-hmm. And there's going to be a lot of frustration again if that happens. Absolutely.
Okay. Well, thanks for being with us, Erkan.
Thank you very much.
And Steve, before we continue our discussion, and I also would like to have you weigh in on what's going to happen in February, I want to remind everyone that you can view or listen to this program anytime by downloading our podcasts at globaljournalist.org. You can also find interesting articles, photos, and interviews related to our program on our website. Right now, it features an article on the foreign media's coverage of the U.S. government shutdown and an explanatory piece on the shutdown and the debt ceiling. Please send us questions or comments via globaljournalist@kbia.org or our Facebook page. You could also follow us on Twitter at globaljourn. So, Steve, are we going to have a part two in February?
Your guess is as good as mine. Obviously, as was stated, the can has been kicked down the road, and we could see an impact in this part of the world if there is another political impasse in Washington. But so far, the shutdown effect was really a domestic issue, and the largest impact is the hit that the United States economy will take from what just happened. But little of that has had a direct impact to or from Southeast Asia. Now, if the U.S. Treasury had gone into technical default, I think it would have been something that would have had significant effects in this region, especially if markets had begun to react with panic. Mm-hmm. So I don't cover Washington, right. I cover Asia. So your guess is good as mine as to what's going to happen after the new year.
Now let's talk about trade, because do you think that there's the problems and the absence from the summits affected the future of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, for example?
Well, my interpretation is that the TPP has significant barriers to overcome, and its success or failure was really not going to be determined by a brief intervention by the U.S. president at the summits here, which of course didn't happen. I certainly wouldn't place large money betting that the pact will be completed by the end of this year, as has been the goal. Most of the technical hurdles have been cleared, but there are now significant political decisions to be made in Washington and other capitals and a number of sensitive trade areas for TPP to be concluded.
And do these trade dynamics, do they also affect just overall relations and how the countries communicate?
Well, I think there's been so far very good communications, because with TPP is not a hostile type of negotiation. It's not a zero-sum game. It's meant to be a win-win for everybody who's participating in it. Of course, China is as outside of it, and so China perhaps potentially has the most to lose from TPP, according to some people. But there's another philosophy that these sort of trade deals are good for everybody because of the obvious effects that they have by opening borders and bringing up all sorts of economies, et cetera. So, and the Chinese are putting together their own trade deals as well. Okay. We don't really know what TPP is really going to look at. I always hesitate to use on the air, I have to tell you, the words free trade agreement, because they're never really truly free trade agreements.
Yeah, everybody covers that.
Free trade agreements.
Everybody's out for their own benefit, right?
Well, there are certain sectors that are always held back, or there's such long timelines, and so a lot of us, I think, grow a little bit cynical about calling these free trade agreements.
Well, Steve, we'll have to leave it there. I really appreciate you being with us today and offering this perspective on the issue of the crazy goings-on in Washington.
My pleasure.
Okay. Global Journalist is produced by the Reynolds Journalism Institute and the Missouri School of Journalism. Joining us today was Steve Herman of the Voice of America in Southeast Asia, and Erkan Azdin, the Danish Broadcasting Corporation's correspondent in Washington. Global Journalist is directed by Travis McMillan, audio by Pat Akers. Raymond Tungakar is our executive producer. John O'Connor was the lead producer. Free Press Watch is up next, and join us again next week for another Global Journalist. I'm David Reed.
And now, Free Press Watch, Global Journalist's weekly rundown of the major events affecting press freedom around your world. I'm Casey Morell. We start with an update to a story we brought you last week. Venezuelan journalist Victor Hugo Donaire was arrested during his radio broadcast after discussing corruption in the police forces. He was released after 48 hours in police detention. eBay founder Pierre Omidyar announced that he plans to found a new journalistic endeavor with noted investigative journalist Glenn Greenwald. Greenwald broke the NSA leaks story to The Guardian, along with filmmaker Laura Poitras, who is also joining the organization. National security writer Jeremy Scahill will also write for the outlet, which is currently unnamed. A three-person crew working for Sky News Arabia was found missing in Syria while covering humanitarian aspects of the civil war. Sky News Arabia, which is based in Abu Dhabi, last had contact with the crew on the morning of October 15th. This disappearance came less than a week after the French Foreign Ministry announced two more French journalists had been taken hostage. Reporters Without Borders says that since March 2011, 37 foreign journalists have been kidnapped in Syria. 17 of them are still missing. For more information on these and other stories involving press freedom around your world, please visit our website. That's globaljournalist.org. Thanks for joining us this week on Global Journalist. I'm Casey Morell.